It is a joy to watch a sports team in action when they work well together, when they seem to be in sync with each other. But I also think that it is a pathetic affair to view a team of individuals each seeking to be the star. That is not enjoyable to watch. Baseball fans would say that that latter description fits the New York Yankees baseball team of several years ago. It was a talent-laden team, but it didn't go very far as a team. And when that happens, people naturally ask, well, why? Why, if they were so good, they had so much talent, didn't they do well? Well, some would say, and I would be among those, that there were too many players looking to pad their own statistics. Too many players on that team not willing to work together as a team. Too many looking at it as an individual endeavor rather than as a joint team effort and endeavor. It is sad, I think, to watch a very talented team squander its potential through selfishness. And what is true in the sports world is also true in the church. Few things more quickly destroy the potential of God's church than when a few members of a church are more interested in making a name for themselves than they are interested in working together in a partnership the way God planned. This morning we continue our study in Paul's letter to the Philippians. We come to chapter 2 and the first part of a two-part section on humility in the church. Today we talk about mostly the concept of humility and the concept of unity. And next week we'll talk about a prime or the prime example of humility in service, that example being Jesus Christ. In this first part, Paul begins to give some definition or put some definition to the kind of humility and the kind of unity that he believes is so crucial for the Philippians, in fact, for any church, including our church today. In the first four verses, we find the beginning of Paul's exhortation to the Philippians regarding humility. So let's go to Philippians chapter 2. Look at those first few verses. And I want you to note, I may only say this one time today, but I want you to be sure to note that Paul's call for humility is specifically spoken to the Philippians about their conduct toward each other. Now, that doesn't mean that what Paul says isn't applicable outside the church or isn't applicable from a believer toward a non-believer, because it is. But Paul's primary emphasis, his primary teaching, is what's going on in the church. And he's talking to the Philippians about the relationships with each other and the humility and unity that they ought to have. In verse 1, Paul lists several foundations for humility and unity. Verse 1, if you have any encouragement from being united with Christ, if any comfort from his love, if any fellowship with the Spirit, if any tenderness and compassion. And we're going to just cut off in the middle of that sentence, because Paul sets himself up here saying, if you have these certain things, you've got a foundation, Philippians. You've got a foundation for humility. You've got a foundation to build some unity within the church. And we ought to, first of all, note that Paul uses the word if. Now, obviously, that's not the Greek word that he uses, the English word. But he uses the word if. And the word if should not be taken so much as a question, as though Paul were exploring, well, do you have any fellowship with the Spirit? Do you have any love? Do you have any encouragement from being united with Christ? A more accurate understanding of that usage would be, well, since you have encouragement from being united with Christ, and since you have love from Him, and since you have fellowship with the Spirit, and since you have tenderness and compassion, the following ought to be true. So he's not asking them whether they had it or not. He's really making a statement. Well, if it's true that you have this, and it is, these are some things that ought to follow. The first foundation, encouragement from being united with Christ. Well, Paul would want the Philippians to think about the encouragement that their union with Christ has brought to their life. What difference has it made? Has it brought some encouragement to their lives? Do they now have some comfort and some assurance about their life that perhaps they did not previously have? Are they encouraged by the fact that they've become a believer? Well, if they are, that is the beginning of a foundation for some humility and for some unity. Because if they don't have a relationship with Christ, they don't have any encouragement from a relationship with Christ, why should they be humble toward each other? And why should they care about unity? But they indeed did have some encouragement, and Paul wanted them to think about what encouraged them about their Christian life. They should allow that to be a foundation. A second foundation, any comfort from his love. Paul would ask the Philippians, think about the comfort that you have received by the fact that you've come to know the love of Christ. You've received that love. Now I want you to turn around and I want you to give that love. You've received it from Christ. Now share it, specifically and particularly with each other. And because you've got that love, again, you've got a foundation. With love, you have a foundation to be humble. With love, you have a tool with which to create unity within the Philippian church. The third foundation, if there is any fellowship with the Spirit. The word translated fellowship is the word koinonia, and all you need to know about koinonia is that that is the word often used, almost exclusively used, in the New Testament to refer to that unique fellowship that ought to be true of the church. And it's almost always coupled with, or very often coupled with, the presence of God's Spirit, suggesting that this kind of fellowship does not exist outside of the work of God's Spirit. In other words, if God is not present, this depth of fellowship probably is not going to be present either. To some degree, the Philippians did know fellowship between themselves and among themselves, because God's Spirit was present. So they did know some fellowship of the Spirit. Paul's encouragement would be, let that Spirit inspire even deeper fellowship, even deeper humility, even deeper unity among you. The fourth and the final foundation that Paul mentions is, if you have any tenderness, if you have any compassion. Well, they, even from their pre-Christian days, may have been somewhat tender, somewhat compassionate. Certainly some of them weren't. But some of them knew tenderness. Some of them had ability to be tender, the ability to be compassionate. And certainly since they became believers, God's Spirit had been at work in their individual lives. And they ought to build on that foundation to bring about greater humility and greater unity within the church. So those are four foundations that Paul says, you've got these things true, use them as foundations to build humility, to build unity within the church. And then in verse 2, Paul, having spoken of these foundations, goes on to give a description of the unity that he has in mind. When Paul speaks of unity for the Philippians, this is what he's thinking of. Verse 2. Then make my joy complete by being like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and purpose. You notice that Paul makes this a personal thing. He says, make my joy complete. Well, why would Paul make it a personal thing like that? Why would he use his desires as a motivating factor for the Philippians? Well, go back in chapter 1. Look at verse 3 in chapter 1. Remind yourselves how Paul felt about these people. In verse 3 of chapter 1, Paul says, I thank my God every time I remember you. And that first week, we talked about the unity that Paul felt with these believers, particularly because he was imprisoned under house arrest. And then in verse 5, he speaks of the fact that they had partnership, a partnership in the gospel. So they're not just somebody that Paul is writing to that he doesn't care about, but they're somebody, a group of somebody that he cares very deeply about. He's concerned about them. He wants to see humility and unity so he can feel joyful that their partnership is advancing, that they're doing their work, the work of the church. And he must have hoped and believed that the Philippians felt that partnership with him, and that they would not only want to please God, first of all, but that secondarily they'd want to please Paul as well, because they saw him as a partner, and they respected what he had to say. Paul gives three descriptions of this unity that he would like to see. He first of all says, be like-minded. And when we see a word like that or a phrase like that, probably the first thing that we would think of is if you and I are going to be like-minded, it would seem to suggest that we ought to think the same way. And there's some truth to that. However, it's not merely an intellectual term. And common sense ought to tell us that. Would it make any sense for Paul to say to the Philippians, I want all of you to think exactly the same way. I want all of you to have exactly the same opinions about everything. I want you to be in full agreement about everything that you believe and everything that you think. Well, what would have been the result if Paul had said that and had meant that? That would have set them up for division because they would have fought about, well, what is that one thing that we're going to think about this subject? And what is that one thing we're going to think about this subject? And what is that one thing we're going to believe about this doctrine and that doctrine and the other doctrine? Well, it would have set them up for even less humility and less unity. Besides the fact that common sense tells you we're not talking about mere intellect and mere thinking, the word itself means more than intellect. It also means to have a similar or a like emotional state, an attitude, a will. It's a very, very broad word. It's a very general word. The next two descriptive phrases further explain what Paul may have meant. He secondly said in verse 2, I want you to have the same love. If they shared the same love, they would be sharing the love of Christ. And if they were sharing the love of Christ, they would love the things that Jesus loved. If they were sharing the love of Christ, they would share the humility of Christ. And if they shared the love of Christ, there would be some unity because there would be some substance or there would be some glue. There would be a tool to allow them and to help them to love each other. With the love of Christ as a bond, personal ambition would be able to be set aside. And then Paul says, I want you also to be one in spirit and purpose. And that, in my mind, captures the intent. It's easier for me personally to relate to that phrase. I think that phrase cuts to the heart of the matter. Paul said, be of one spirit and one purpose. The church has a purpose diametrically opposed to self-interest and self-promotion. When the Philippians, each one individually, knows that the church exists for their mutual edification, that the church exists to spread the gospel of Christ, they will recognize the importance of humility and the importance of unity, because those things cannot be accomplished if there isn't a togetherness. There will not be mutual edification if there is no humility and if there is no unity. And the message about the good news of Christ will not go forward if there is not an ability to work well together. Or at least the effort will be hindered. The Philippians might not all think the same. They might not all talk the same. They might not all act the same. In fact, they wouldn't think, talk, or act the same. But humility and unity would indicate that they were in agreement with each other about the general direction of the church. And they were moving in the same direction. And that's what Paul longed for, that they would be moving together, maybe along parallel paths, but headed in the same direction. Having described the unity that he desires, Paul talks about balanced humility in verses 3 and 4. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. In verse 3, Paul lists what I would call unity killers. There probably are more than just these three, but these three really do kill unity. The first is selfish ambition. And another way that that could be translated is to say rivalry. Selfish ambition or rivalry is a unity killer. If there is a Philippian in the church who has a driving desire to make a name for himself, there is not much humility there, and there is not much desire for unity in the church. If a Philippian has a desire to be in control of what's going on all the time, humility and unity will be severely damaged. If a Philippian has an inclination to head off in his own direction and just kind of do his own thing apart from the body, there isn't going to be very much unity. Selfish ambition or rivalry is a killer of unity. There's a second killer that Paul mentions, and that is vain conceit. It's an interesting term, and I don't know if you'll find this as fascinating as I did. In the Greek culture, in the time that Paul wrote, this was a phrase that literally meant a person who asserts, usually arrogantly, that they have the one and only right opinion, but who is in fact in error. It describes a person who will fight to insist that their opinion is not only right, but it's the only one. And they really don't care if they're right or wrong. They just have decided something is going to be true, and they're going to push it regardless, usually arrogantly. What do you suppose that would do to a church if somebody acted in that way? It's not very humble, and it certainly is not going to create unity. It's an abrasive personality that says, I know what ought to be done, and this is the way we're going to do it, and if you don't jump on, you can just leave. The person who has that kind of a personality will kill humility and unity as quickly as anything else in the church. A third killer, and Paul mentions it not so much by name, and I'm going to just pull out a phrase. A third killer is when a person makes their personal interests and desires more important than anybody else's. When a person cares consistently more about themselves and their wants and desires than for the wants and desires of the others. That's a killer that really elevates me above you, or you personally, elevates you above everybody else, and you think you're the one that has to be served. And Paul apparently was concerned that some of the Philippians had this kind of an attitude, and he knew that that would just destroy humility and unity in the church. In today's language, we might say that this is a person who not merely looks out for number one, but who is only looking out for number one. What do you think that attitude would do for humility and unity in the Philippian church? Nothing positive. Paul's solution is there's got to be some balance here. In verse 3, Paul says, in humility, consider others better than yourselves. Consider others better than yourselves. Now, if you and I take that phrase alone out of its context, the phrase might be interpreted to mean that the Philippians should always put themselves at the bottom of the heap. That they should always make everybody else's needs and everybody else's desires more important. That they should always attend to everybody else's needs before theirs. But I don't believe that's what Paul taught. And I don't believe that's what he meant. He balances himself out very well in verse 4. When in verse 4 he says, each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Paul clarifies himself and balances himself. Both their own personal interests and the interests of others were to be considered important. Both were to be given weight. Both were to be given value. Neither should be excluded. They should not exclude another's needs and concentrate only on their own. Neither should they exclude their own needs and concentrate only on everybody else's needs. Jesus himself gave from the depths of his being to help other people, but he also considered his own needs. When Jesus was physically or emotionally spent, he got away from the crowds even though the needs had not all been met. When Jesus knew that he needed to spend time with God, he would get away for a significant number of hours, several times, even a whole night, because that was his need. He hadn't met everybody else's needs first, but yet Jesus still gave and gave and gave. He balanced his own needs and the needs of other people. I have no doubt that if Paul were writing a letter to the church, he would address the issues of humility and unity in a very similar way, just like he wrote to the Philippians. We ought to give some thought now then, if Paul wrote those very same things to us, not to the Philippians, how would we receive his words? How would we attempt to put his words into reality in our lives? Well, the first thing that we ought to do is to reaffirm our foundations for humility and unity. Those very same foundations that Paul mentioned to the Philippians. So I ask you these questions. How can you personally bring humility and unity from the encouragement that you have from being united with Christ? Or asked in the negative, how can you understand the meaning and significance of your union with Christ and not strive for humility? And not strive to have unity with each other. As you and I think about the joy that we've come to know in Christ, we have a reason and a foundation for being humble. Because we recognize the gravity of our sin that caused Christ to die. That ought to humble us. And if it humbles us before God and before Christ, it ought to humble us before each other. And I think that it does, and I think that it can do that. The second foundation, how can you personally bring humility and unity from the comfort that you have from Christ's love or the knowledge that you have from Christ's love? We know what Christ did for us in love, and that ought to humble us, but Christ puts his very love within us. We use the phrase that when we become Christians, Christ comes and lives in our heart. And we often use that phrase and maybe don't think about what it means or what it could mean. Hopefully it means that the love that Jesus Christ exhibited as he lived on earth is resident inside of me and inside of you. And if that's true, and it is true to some degree for all of us, we have a foundation within inside of our very being, a foundation for humility and a foundation for unity. Because that love can come forward out of our lives toward each other. How can we bring humility and unity from fellowship with God's Spirit? Well, our cooperation is important in this endeavor. If you and I want to be humble, if we want to be in unity or continue the unity that we have, our cooperation in that effort is necessary. But ultimately, God's Spirit stimulates the deepest humility and the deepest unity or fellowship within the church. We ought to be sincerely praying that God would, in our own personal lives, each of us praying for ourselves, ask that God would make sure his Spirit is there, and that his Spirit would be carving an ability to be humble, that his Spirit would be carving within us a great desire for unity, and that further, God's Spirit would be present among us corporately, that as we meet together and gather together, that God's very presence is there, molding us into the people that he wants us to become. And then the last of the foundations. How can you bring humility and unity from tenderness and compassion? Well, obviously, each one of us here this morning knows some tenderness and some compassion. And in fact, we probably have a significant degree of tenderness and compassion regardless of the fact that we're believers. Even before we were believers, to some degree, we knew a bit of tenderness and a bit of compassion. But as we've come to be Christians, we hope that God is creating even more tenderness and even more compassion within us. And as we are tender toward each other and compassionate toward each other, we will be humble. And if we are tender and compassionate, that will create those bonds of unity and help them to grow even stronger than they already are. The second step in application would be trying to characterize the kind of unity that we're seeking. Paul told the Philippians, when I'm thinking of unity, Philippians, this is what I envision happening among you. What would we envision among ourselves? I think we have a great deal of unity. What do we envision that unity being like, or that unity even growing toward? Well, Paul would tell us to be like-minded, having the same love, being one in spirit and purpose, just like he told the Philippians. And of course, you and I do not all think alike. We do not all have the same opinions. We do not all have the same talents and abilities. And we do not all serve the same function in the church. And you've heard me say this before. If we were all exactly alike, some of us would be unnecessary. But God has made us different because we are all necessary. When I think of us being unified, I think about all of us driving down the same road in different cars, different vehicles, trucks, motorcycles, all driving down the same road in the same direction, encouraging each other along the way, helping each other whenever we have a breakdown or a slowdown along the way, when we run out of fuel, when we have a flat tire, helping each other, headed down the same direction. Maybe not on the exact same lane, but on parallel tracks, heading the same direction. That's what I view. I view a unity in which we respect the differences that exist between us. I don't accept the other person only if he or she thinks, speaks, and acts as I do, or as I think he or she ought to. When we each have part in a single direction in the church, there's no need to fight for control, because all of us are important. All of us are valuable. And that's the way the church ought to be viewed. If all of us have an important part, and we do, and we're unified in the direction we're heading, there's no need for us to control, because we're all moving in a unified single direction, regardless of our role, regardless of our task. Then lastly, how do we define a well-balanced humility? We'll talk about this, I suspect, during our discussion time. What does it mean to be humble in a balanced way? Well, first of all, we would want to avoid those unity killers that Paul mentioned. If any of us has selfish ambition to make a name for self, or to control others, or to move off in our own direction, the church's character of humility and unity is going to suffer greatly. Selfish ambition will have to be given up. If any of us regularly insists that our opinion is the only right opinion, that it must be accepted and it must be followed by others, that too will carve deep gouges in our humility, in our unity. In fact, if that attitude exists, there will need to be some loving confrontation so that that attitude cannot wreak havoc upon our church. If any of us often or always makes personal interests and desires more important than anybody else's, again, our humility will suffer and our unity will begin to be broken down. And perhaps again, there would be some need for loving confrontation. But those are the negatives. Not only must we avoid those unity killers, those negatives, but we need to seek balance in our humility. And I think the operative word is balance. I want to make a statement, and I want you to be sure that you hear this. I alluded to this earlier, but I want to make it in a very strong way right now. Jesus did not always meet others' needs before his own needs. I want you to think about that. Jesus did not always meet others' needs before his needs. Go back and look at verse 3. Consider others better than yourselves. If we were to take that phrase to the extreme, it might suggest that whenever you have a need and I have a need, I should always meet yours first. Well, Jesus did not always do that, as I noted by the fact that he sometimes got away because he needed to rest or he needed to pray. He did not always meet everybody else's needs ahead of his own needs. Obviously, others' needs were extremely high on Jesus' list of priorities because he gave his life up for others' needs, your needs and mine. But he didn't always meet other people's needs before his own. So where is the balance for us? Well, there is a theological phrase thrown around called worm theology. And worm theology is a way of saying, well, maybe we ought to recognize how rotten and how awful we are, and we ought to crawl around on the floor. And that's an extreme way of stating it, but it gets the point across. There is no place and no room and no, it's not proper for you and I to crawl around on the floor before other people. We should not consider ourselves as doormats for other people. That's not what Paul talked about. We are to give very high value to each other's needs. When he spoke about love, one of Jesus' commands to his followers, quoted from the Old Testament, was, "Love your neighbor as yourself." When we are in balance in our humility, we will love ourselves and others. We can and should treat ourselves very well. The balance is that we then treat each other very well also. Paul never said the Philippians should forget about their own needs. His statement of balance is clear and simple. Verse 4. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. If each of us would take as a personal creed, I will serve myself very well, and I will serve my fellow believers at least as well, humility and unity will always be a defining characteristic in our church. As of a sports team that works well together, may it be said of Fair Oaks Community Church that we work well together. May we be a pleasure to watch as we follow the example of Jesus Christ by looking out both for ourselves and for each other.